It was carved from the earth by tectonic fury, divided by empire, and reclaimed by blood. Panama isn't just a country, it's a corridor of power, a prize fought over by kings, colonizers, drug lords, and superpowers. For centuries, outsiders controlled its destiny. But this is the story of how a nation fought to reclaim its voice through betrayal, revolution, dictatorship, and defiance. From gold routes to gunfire, from canal riots to climate battles, this is the untold saga of Panama, the land between two oceans, and the people who refuse to be a bridge for others while going nowhere themselves. Welcome to the History of the Caribbean's podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Panama, A Journey Through Time, Episode 3. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 9, A Country Divided by a Canal. It was only 10 miles wide, a sliver of land snaking from ocean to ocean. But within its narrow borders, Panama ceased to belong to itself. Here, fences replaced flags, checkpoints replaced unity, and history split down the middle like a canal through a continent. The canal zone didn't just divide the country, it divided the soul of Panama. When the Hay-Bunuvarilla Treaty was signed in 1903, it granted the United States, in perpetuity, sovereign rights over the canal zone, a 10-mile-wide corridor stretching from Colón on the Caribbean to Panama City on the Pacific. What that meant in practice was that the United States had carved a country within a country, a strip of sovereign U.S. territory that bisected Panama like a surgical incision. At first, Panamanians were told the canal would bring prosperity, that it would elevate Panama from forgotten province to global hub, that it would modernize, stabilize, and unify. And in some ways, it did, but only on the surface. Beneath the headlines, the construction of the Panama Canal also laid the foundation for decades of division. The creation of the zone. Once completed in 1914, the canal zone rapidly transformed into a self-contained American colony. It had its own laws, its own police force, its own courts, and even its own currency. Panamanians were paid in balboas, Americans in U.S. dollars. It operated under the direct jurisdiction of the U.S. Canal Zone government, a civilian and military administration headquartered in the Balboa Heights section of Panama City, yet politically and culturally insulated from the rest of the country. Within the canal zone, pristine roads ran straight and wide. Lawns were manicured. Schools followed the U.S. curriculum. Hospitals were modern, efficient, and segregated by race. Stores offered American goods, cheaper and more plentiful than those available in Panama. Churches, clubs, movie theaters, swimming pools, baseball fields, all were strictly regulated for use by American citizens, with Panamanians often barred from access or relegated to second-class status. To cross into the zone, Panamanians needed permits or work documents. They were searched at checkpoints, questioned, and sometimes denied entry without explanation. Within their own borders, they became foreigners. Two worlds, one nation. To walk from Panama City into the zone was like stepping through a mirror. On one side, noisy, crowded streets full of honking taxis, bustling markets, and the scent of grilled corn and fried plantains. On the other, quiet, ordered neighborhoods with white picket fences and American flags fluttering in front yards. In the city, Spanish rang out with Caribbean cadence. In the zone, English reigned, flat, clipped, bureaucratic. Panamanians called the American residents of the zone Zonians. They were seen as untouchable, entitled, and sometimes condescending. To Zonians, Panamanians were locals, a convenient workforce, tolerated, but never fully included. At its core, the canal zone functioned as a segregated state. Racial discrimination was codified into the employment system. Workers were classified as gold roll or silver roll. The gold roll, white Americans and Europeans, received high wages, housing allowances, and privileges. The silver roll, Afro-Caribbeans, mestizos, and other non-white laborers, were paid less, denied benefits, and housed in overcrowded barracks with communal bathrooms and limited sanitation. These were not abstract injustices. They were daily humiliations. Children watched their parents submit to search and inspection just across into jobs cleaning Zonian homes. skilled Panamanian laborers were passed over for promotions in favor of less experienced American workers. Afro-Caribbean laborers, who had built the canal with their bare hands, were shut out of its rewards. Meanwhile, American children played in tree-lined parks. Their parents shopped in commissaries stocked with imported goods. They lived in what Panamanians came to call a zone of privilege. And yet, the two communities remained deeply intertwined. Panamanians cooked, cleaned, and labored inside the zone. They taught in zone schools, repaired roads, delivered mail, and treated patients in hospitals. They made the zone work, but were never permitted to belong to it. Education and identity. Even education became a dividing line. Zonian schools were fully American, following U.S. curricula and holidays. Panamanian children, even those living near the zone, were excluded unless their parents held high-level jobs or dual citizenship. They learned a version of history that omitted their country's struggle and glorified U.S. expansion. Meanwhile, in Panamanian schools, students were taught the truth, that the canal had been built by foreign hands, yes, but on stolen land. That Panama had never agreed to the treaty that took the zone, that a strip of its own territory was being administered as a foreign enclave. As a result, a generational nationalism began to grow, especially among young people. They saw the canal zone as both a symbol of progress and an open wound. It represented what Panama could be, clean, functional, modern, but also what Panama was not allowed to become. It was a constant reminder of exclusion, culture, and resistance. Despite the control, Panamanians didn't remain silent. They wrote songs. They published editorials. They staged demonstrations. They painted murals and told stories. Intellectuals, poets, and artists used their voices to expose the injustice of the zone. University students began organizing. Labor unions circulated pamphlets demanding equal pay for Panamanian workers. Clergy spoke of sovereignty from the pulpit. Tensions grew. Sometimes, protests were peaceful. Other times, they exploded into violence. In 1947, when the U.S. tried to expand its military bases across Panama after World War II, student protests forced the Panamanian National Assembly to reject the proposal. In 1959, further demonstrations erupted, met with tear gas and rubber bullets. People were beaten. Some were arrested. But the protests continued. The dream was no longer just about shared benefits. It was about ownership, dignity, identity. It was about the canal, yes, but also about being whole. The zone becomes a symbol. To the outside world, the canal zone was an engineering marvel, a symbol of American ingenuity and international logistics. But inside Panama, it was something else entirely, an island of foreign control in the heart of a sovereign state. By the 1960s, a new generation of Panamanians, raised in the shadow of this division, were no longer content to accept it. The polite diplomacy of the past was giving way to raw, vocal nationalism. Students took to the streets waving Panamanian flags. Speakers shouted into megaphones. Protesters clashed with police and U.S. soldiers. Fires burned, glass shattered, and the chant rang out, La Zona es nuestra. The zone is ours. It was more than just a slogan. It was a claim to identity. A declaration that Panama could no longer be a country divided by treaties it hadn't signed, by borders it hadn't drawn, by powers it hadn't invited. The line drawn across Panama had begun to blur, but it would take blood to erase it completely. That reckoning was coming, and it would arrive not with diplomacy, but with death on a January day that would burn itself into the soul of the nation. Chapter 10, Nationalism Awakens. For decades, the division was tolerated, enforced by laws, reinforced by silence, and explained away by treaties most Panamanians had never seen. But fences rust, silences break, and when pride is trampled long enough, even the smallest insult can light the fuse of history. In 1964, Panama did not wake up. It roared. The seeds of rebellion had been growing for years, planted by injustice, watered by memory, and fed by the daily humiliation of being a citizen in your own country and still feeling like a guest. generations of Panamanians had grown up with a contradiction of the Canal Zone, a prosperous strip of American-controlled land slicing the nation in half like a foreign bone embedded in flesh. For those outside the fence, it was a symbol of exclusion. For those inside it, particularly the Americans known as Zonians, it was a home they were willing to defend. But by the early 1960s, a new force had risen that neither treaty nor tank could contain. Panamanian nationalism, bold, uncompromising, and born not in war rooms, but in classrooms. The rise of student nationalism. The classrooms of Panama's public schools became the front lines of awakening. Panamanian textbooks, especially in urban areas, did not shy away from the truth. Children were taught that the 1903 Hay-Bunau-Varilla Treaty had been signed without Panamanian input, that Philippe Bunau-Varilla, a Frenchman, had no right to speak for a newborn nation, that Panama's sovereignty had been sold out before it had even drawn its first breath. History lessons became manifestos. Teachers emphasized what had been taken, not just land, but dignity. They explained how Panamanians had been relegated to second-class status in their own homeland, how the Canal Zone operated as a separate country, and how generations of laborers had died building a canal that didn't even belong to them. By the 1960s, the students of Panama were no longer satisfied with education. They demanded action. The flag becomes a weapon. In 1963, U.S. President John F. Kennedy, in a gesture toward diplomacy, had ordered that the Panamanian flag be flown alongside the U.S. flag in certain parts of the Canal Zone, a symbolic but important concession. But his assassination in November of that year threw everything into limbo. His successor, Lyndon B. Johnson, faced pressure from U.S. citizens in the zone who saw the Panamanian flag as a threat to their sovereignty. Many Zonians refused to comply. To the Americans in the zone, the flag debate was administrative. To Panamanians, it was existential. Flying the Panamanian flag in the zone was not about fabric or symbolism. It was about recognition, legitimacy, a small, visible acknowledgement that Panama's soul had not been completely amputated from the land. And when that flag was insulted, torn, or removed, it was as if the wound was reopened in public. January 9, 1964, the day the flag bled. The tipping point came on January 9, 1964. That afternoon, Panamanian students from Instituto Nacional, carrying their nation's flag and dressed in their school uniforms, marched toward the Canal Zone entrance in Panama City, intending to raise the Panamanian flag at Balboa High School, as agreed upon in the symbolic joint flag policy. They were met by Zonian students and residents, many of whom surrounded the school, waving U.S. flags, shouting insults, and refusing entry. Tensions escalated. At some point in the chaos, the Panamanian flag was torn. Whether it was ripped intentionally or torn accidentally in the scuffle remains debated to this day. But in that moment, it didn't matter. The flag had been desecrated, on national television, in front of the world. Within hours, news spread like wildfire. Radio broadcasts described the torn flag as an act of war. Angry crowds gathered in Panama City. Protesters surged toward the zone. Students, workers, and teachers marched shoulder to shoulder. Riots broke out in Cologne, David, and other cities. Government buildings were surrounded, and the air grew thick with slogans, chants, and the smell of burning tires. The U.S. military responded with tear gas, rubber bullets, and then live rounds. American troops and Canal Zone police opened fire on Panamanian demonstrators in multiple locations. 22 Panamanians were killed, many of them students. Hundreds were wounded. 4 Americans also died. But the number didn't tell the story. The images did. A Panamanian teenager, barefoot, blood-soaked, cradling the torn flag as he collapsed near the zone wall. A mother wailing over the body of her son, killed by a soldier from a country she had never voted for. Crowds tearing down American flags in protest, replacing them with the red, white, and blue of Panama, not out of hatred, but out of desperate assertion that they existed. The aftermath, mourning and mobilization. The days that followed were surreal. Funeral processions for the dead turned into parades of national unity. Black cloth hung from balconies. priests denounced violence from their pulpits. Journalists from across Latin America arrived in Panama to cover the unfolding crisis. Internationally, the reaction was swift. Latin American nations condemned the United States' use of force. The Organization of American States, OAS, convened emergency meetings. Embassies received letters of protest. The U.S. found itself on the defensive, not from communism or dictatorship, but from the righteous fury of a small nation demanding respect. On January 10th, Panama formally broke diplomatic relations with the United States, the first time in history that had ever occurred between the two countries. A line had been crossed. The flag that bled had become a martyr. And from that wound rose a new national identity, less concerned with past submission and more focused on future sovereignty. The students became the voice of the nation. What made January 9th so powerful was that it wasn't orchestrated by generals or politicians. It wasn't ordered from above. It was led by students, barely adults, unarmed, idealistic, and unwilling to be ignored. They came with books and banners, not bullets. And they succeeded where decades of diplomacy had failed. They put Panama's sovereignty at the center of global attention. Within months, the U.S. and Panama resumed negotiations. Though full control of the canal would remain out of reach for decades, the events of Martyrs' Day, as January 9th came to be called, marked the beginning of the end for U.S. dominion over the isthmus. More importantly, it marked the beginning of a new era in Panamanian identity, the legacy of 1964. Martyrs' Day became a sacred date, etched into the national psyche. Every January 9th, Panamanians gather to remember the students who died holding their country's flag. Their names are taught in schools. Their stories are passed down like prayers. They did not just protest a flag. They reclaimed the right to define their nation. What followed was not immediate liberation, but momentum, a movement that would span decades, endure setbacks, and face new challenges. But the resolve was now unshakable. Panama had found its voice, and the world was forced to listen. Because once a people rise together in mourning and pride, once they bury their children in the name of sovereignty, once the blood of youth soaks the soil of protest, the nation that emerges can never be silenced again. Chapter 11, The Strongman, Torrijos Rises. He didn't come draped in medals or mounted on tanks. He didn't seize the stage with fire and fury. He emerged quietly, steadily, like smoke rising through a battlefield after the last gunfire has faded. And in that smoke, Panama saw a new kind of leader, not elected, not sainted, but decisive. His name was Omar Torrijos, and he came with promises, contradictions, and a plan to reclaim the soul of a divided country. In the aftermath of Martyrs' Day 1964, Panama was a nation shaken but not broken. The deaths of 22 Panamanians during the flag riots had triggered a surge of national consciousness, but also exposed the deep fault lines within the state. The canal, once viewed as a monument to global trade, was now seen as a symbol of colonial occupation. The U.S. still controlled the canal zone, and Colombia's former colony remained sovereign in name, subordinate in practice. The civilian government, mired in factionalism and corruption, struggled to harness the energy of the protests. Elected leaders cycled in and out of power, but no one seemed capable of unifying the country or challenging the unequal treaty that had haunted Panama since 1903. Into this vacuum stepped the National Guard, and within it a man few knew, but all would come to remember, who was Omar Torrijos. Omar Efren Torrijos Herrera was born in 1929 in the dusty town of Santiago de Veraguas, into a modest family with deep roots in Panama's interior. His father was a teacher, his mother a strict disciplinarian. He was not born into power or wealth, but he was born with something else: ambition, charisma, and an unshakable sense of national pride. As a young man, Torrijos studied at the Latin American Academy in El Salvador before receiving further military training at the School of the Americas in Georgia, where the U.S. trained officers from across Latin America in the art of counterinsurgency. There, he learned the techniques of control, both psychological and tactical. But what Torrijos took from the Americans was not loyalty. It was leverage. He understood how empires operated and how to resist them. By the early 1960s, Torrijos had risen quietly through the ranks of Panama's National Guard, the country's military and internal security force. While others postured, Torrijos observed. While politicians argued, he listened. And when the time came, he acted. The 1968 coup, bloodless, brutal, and inevitable. The civilian government of President Arnulfo Arias, a polarizing nationalist figure who had been elected multiple times and deposed just as often, returned to power in May 1968. But Arias, distrustful of the military and driven by his own ideology, quickly began dismantling the internal structure of the National Guard. It was a miscalculation. On October 11, 1968, the National Guard struck back. Torrijos and his ally Major Boris Martinez led a coup that removed Arias from office while he was out of the country. The transition was swift and without bloodshed, but its implications were enormous. Over the next few months, Torrijos consolidated power. Martinez, initially more visible, was soon sidelined, exiled to Miami after a political fallout. By 1969, Omar Torrijos had become the undisputed ruler of Panama. He did not assume the title of president. Instead, he ruled as commander of the National Guard, blending military authority with civilian influence. Behind the scenes, he controlled the executive branch, dictated policy, and reshaped the nation's identity, not by mandate, but by momentum. The general of the poor. Unlike the stereotypical Latin American strongman, Torrijos didn't seek adoration through vanity or terror. He didn't rename streets after himself or erect golden statues. He wore a simple military uniform, often without decorations. He traveled to rural villages, sat with campesinos, listened to students, met with union leaders. He called himself El General de los Humildes, the General of the Humble. But he was no democratic idealist. Opposition was silenced. Newspapers were censored or shut down. Dissidents were harassed or exiled. Surveillance became standard. The political parties were weakened or banned altogether. Elections were postponed indefinitely. The state became an extension of Torrijos' will. Still, to many Panamanians, especially the poor, he was a hero. Under his rule, sweeping social reforms were enacted. Rural education expanded dramatically, with thousands of new schools built in underserved areas. Literacy campaigns reduced illiteracy across entire regions. Land reform granted titles to thousands of peasant families who had lived for generations on property they did not legally own. Healthcare was extended to areas previously neglected by the state. A new state university opened in Veraguas, bringing higher education to Panama's interior for the first time. These weren't just policies. They were acts of redemption. Torrijos' attempt to balance the scales between the urban elite and the rural forgotten. But his ultimate mission was something deeper, reclaiming the canal. Torrijos and the canal, a national obsession. From the moment he seized power, Torrijos made it clear the Panama Canal would one day belong to Panama. He didn't see the canal as just an economic asset. He saw it as a symbol of humiliation, a scar left by colonial manipulation and foreign control. And he knew that true independence would never come until the Hay-Buenaventura Treaty was undone. He embarked on a relentless international campaign, visiting Latin American capitals, European nations, and even the United Nations, arguing that the U.S. occupation of the canal zone violated Panamanian sovereignty and global justice. He didn't speak with diplomatic polish. He spoke like a soldier with a mission, and the world began to listen. Within Panama, he wove this mission into national identity. The schools were required to teach the history of the treaty and the story of the canal. Posters, poems, murals, and radio broadcasts carried his message. La soberania no se negocia. La soberania se recupera. Sovereignty is not negotiated. It is reclaimed. The man behind the myth. But Torrijos was not without contradictions. He lived a private life filled with excess, traveling in style, keeping mistresses, and consolidating immense personal power. His inner circle operated with nepotism and corruption, diverting state resources and silencing dissent. He remained in power without an election, and though he spoke for the poor, he never surrendered his grip on the military apparatus. Still, he was different from the brutal dictators that plagued other Latin American countries in the Cold War era. He avoided mass executions. He allowed limited criticism. And crucially, he positioned himself as a buffer between Panama and U.S. imperialism. Many Panamanians saw him as their only shield. His most enduring strength? He knew Panama's soul. He knew how to speak to its wounds, to its pride, to its longing for respect. And though he ruled from above, he listened from below, setting the stage for a revolution in diplomacy. By the late 1970s, Torrijos' campaign had reached a fever pitch. After years of pressure, negotiation, and public diplomacy, the United States, under President Jimmy Carter, finally agreed to reconsider the terms of the original treaty. In 1977, at a ceremony in Washington, D.C., Torrijos and Carter signed the Torrijos-Carter Treaties, setting a roadmap for the full transfer of the canal to Panama by December 31, 1999. It was a triumph, and though the canal would not be fully Panamanian until after Torrijos' death, his signature on that document was a promise fulfilled, a quiet victory wrested from a century of silence. The end of a quiet revolution. In 1981, just 4 years after signing the treaties that would define his legacy, Omar Torrijos died in a mysterious plane crash in the mountains of Caco. The official report cited mechanical failure, but rumors of assassination, CIA involvement, and internal betrayal swirled for years. His death left a vacuum, one that would soon be filled by a far darker figure, Manuel Noriega. But in the moment of his death, the nation wept. Because for all his flaws, all his authoritarian tendencies, Torrijos had been their voice, their vessel, their hope. He had dared to say that Panama mattered, that Panama belonged to Panamanians, and that dignity was not a privilege, it was a right. Chapter 12. The Drug Lord Dictator, Noriega's Regime. He wore sunglasses at night. He spoke in riddles, surrounded himself with shadows, and ruled with both a smirk and a scowl. He was the pineapple face, the strawman, the spy, the survivor. His name was Manuel Antonio Noriega, and for over a decade, he was Panama, not its soul, but its scar. When General Omar Torrijos died in that fateful 1981 plane crash, under suspicious circumstances in the fog-drenched mountains of Caco, it was more than the death of a man. It was the death of a vision. Torrijos had been, for all his authoritarian tendencies, a builder of identity, of dignity, of national purpose. Into the vacuum he left behind stepped a very different kind of figure, not a general of the people, but a creature of power, cunning, ruthless, patient. Manuel Noriega had waited his whole life for this moment, the making of a shadow. Noriega was born in 1934 in Panama City, the illegitimate son of a laundress and a merchant. He grew up poor, street smart, and angry, traits that would define his rule. He entered the military through scholarship, training at the Chorrillos Military School in Peru, and later at the infamous U.S. School of the Americas, where he was taught counterinsurgency, intelligence tactics, and psychological warfare. In the 1970s, under Torrijos, Noriega rose rapidly through the ranks of the National Guard, specializing in military intelligence. He became head of G2, Panama's feared secret police. He was a man who kept files on everyone, a master manipulator, a broker of secrets. But what few realized, at least at first, was that Noriega had multiple masters. From the 1960s onward, he had been on the CIA's payroll. He was informant during the Cold War, feeding intelligence on Cuban activity, leftist insurgencies, and regional politics. U.S. officials called him our man in Panama. He was paid hundreds of thousands of dollars, protected from scrutiny, and given room to maneuver in exchange for loyalty. But Noriega was no one's pawn. He played the CIA against drug cartels, dictators, and rebels. He was a triple agent, fluent in corruption. He trafficked in cocaine and information with equal ease. When Torrijos died, Noriega didn't rush to power. He waited, letting civilian presidents cycle through ceremonial roles while he operated behind the scenes. He controlled the military, the courts, the press. And by 1983, he was officially commander of the Panama Defense Forces, PDF, the most powerful man in the country. But unofficially, he already was Panama's ruler, the narco state. Once in power, Noriega remade Panama into a shadow kingdom. At first glance, little changed. Tourists still wandered the streets of Casco Viejo. Cargo ships passed through the canal. Students attended classes. But underneath the surface, fear spread like mold. The media was muzzled. Opposition parties were harassed. Dissidents disappeared, kidnapped, tortured, sometimes dumped in the sea. And behind it all, Noriega's regime quietly opened his doors to the Medellin cartel. He turned Panama into a haven for drug money, a way station for cocaine bound for the U.S., and a laundering hub for dirty fortunes. Pablo Escobar's planes flew in and out of Panama's airstrips. Cartel dollars flowed through Panamanian banks. Narco-traffickers purchased properties, bribed officials, and lived openly in luxury, protected by Noriega's guarantees. And Noriega profited, not just in cash, but in leverage. He knew the names. He had the documents. He kept track of every transaction, every secret. To him, information was currency. He sold secrets to the Cubans, the Sandinistas, the Americans. He played all sides. He called it diplomacy. Others called it treason. But at home, his grip grew tighter. The disappearance of Hugo Spadafora. In 1985, the mask cracked. Hugo Spadafora, a physician, intellectual, and former deputy health minister, returned to Panama after years abroad. Once aligned with Torrijos, he had grown disillusioned with the direction the country had taken under Noriega. He publicly accused the regime of turning Panama into a narco state and of complicity in drug trafficking and political repression. Noriega's response was swift and brutal. Spadafora was arrested at the border by PDF soldiers. Hours later, his tortured, decapitated body was found stuffed into a U.S. mailbag. His head was never recovered. The message was clear. Dissent would not be tolerated. The murder sent shockwaves across Panama and the international community. Even longtime supporters in Washington began to question their alliance. But Noriega didn't blink. He tightened his grip. He knew that as long as he was useful, he was untouchable. The end of the Faustian bargain. By the late 1980s, Noriega's position began to crumble. The Iran-Contra scandal had exposed the deep entanglement between U.S. covert operations and Latin American dictators. Congress was furious. Human rights groups were growing louder. And Panama's own economy was teetering under the weight of corruption and sanctions. The CIA, once Noriega's patron, turned cold. President Ronald Reagan distanced himself. By 1987, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration had opened formal investigations into Noriega's cartel ties. U.S. newspapers published exposés detailing the general's wealth, his cocaine connections, his Swiss accounts. Inside Panama, unrest boiled. Civilians took to the streets. Protesters were met with tear gas, beatings, and bullets. The Civic Crusade, a coalition of churches, business leaders, students, and NGOs, organized mass demonstrations demanding Noriega's resignation. Thousands marched in Panama City, banging pots and waving black flags. Their chant was simple: Fuera Noriega. Noriega out. In response, Noriega deployed thugs. He called them dignity battalions, paramilitary squads dressed in red shirts who beat and intimidated demonstrators, raided newsrooms, and enforced loyalty with fists and sticks. In 1988, the U.S. indicted Noriega on drug trafficking and money laundering charges. The diplomatic mask was off. Panama had become an international pariah. But Noriega refused to go. He rigged elections. He silenced judges. And when his own officers tried to stage a coup in 1989, he crushed them swiftly and publicly, executing the plotters and parading their broken bodies as warnings. The spark that ignited the invasion. The final spark came in December 1989 when a U.S. Marine officer, Lieutenant Robert Paz, was killed by Panamanian Defense Forces at a roadblock. The incident enraged President George H.W. Bush, who had already prepared contingency plans for military intervention. When Noriega declared a state of war against the United States, it gave Washington the justification it needed. Operation Just Cause. On the night of December 20, 1989, U.S. forces invaded Panama in the largest American military operation since Vietnam. Over 27,000 U.S. troops, along with tanks, helicopters, and airstrikes, descended on Panama City, Cologne, and key military installations. The official objective: capture Manuel Noriega, protect American lives, restore democracy, and secure the canal. The assault was overwhelming. PDF soldiers fought back where they could, but they were no match. Urban neighborhoods burned. Civilians were caught in the crossfire. The poor district of El Chorrillo was devastated, bombed, and set ablaze. The death toll remains disputed. U.S. officials claimed around 500 deaths, while Panamanian sources insist it exceeded 2,000. Noriega fled. For days, he was invisible, hidden in safe houses, moving between allies. Finally, he sought asylum in the Vatican Embassy in Panama City. U.S. forces surrounded the compound and, in a move both surreal and symbolic, blasted heavy metal music 24 hours a day, Van Halen, Metallica, AC/DC, to drive him out. On January 3, 1990, Noriega surrendered. He was flown to Miami, tried in U.S. federal court, and convicted on drug trafficking, racketeering, and money laundering charges. He would spend 20 years in prison and later serve additional sentences in France and Panama. His reign was over, a nation left to rebuild. The fall of Noriega did not bring immediate peace. Panama was left broken, traumatized, burned, economically strained, and emotionally fractured. But it was also, for the first time in generations, free to breathe. The dictator was gone. The people had endured. But the canal was still not theirs. That too would come, but not until the final chapter of this long, turbulent journey.